Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can be heard live streaming worldwide. My guest today is author and Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Hedrick Smith, author of Who Stole the American Dream? And today's discussion is how it came about and what possibly we can do to solve that problem. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. To that end, many of my shows are devoted to that purpose. Welcome, Hedrick Smith, to the Advocates.
It's very nice to be with you, Richard.
Thank you. Hedrick Smith, the Pulitzer Prize-winning former New York Times reporter, editor, and Emmy Award-winning producer, correspondent, has covered Washington and world capitals for the New York Times, authored several best-selling books, and created 20 award-winning PBS primetime specials and miniseries. For 26 years, Mr. Smith served as a correspondent for the Times in Washington, Moscow, Cairo, Saigon, Paris, and the American South. In 1971, as the chief diplomatic correspondent, he was a member of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team that produced the Pentagon Papers series. In 1974, he won the Pulitzer Prize for international reporting from Russia and Eastern Europe. And from 1976 to 88, he was New York Times Washington Bureau chief and chief correspondent. He began creating documentaries for PBS in 1989 with his adaptation of his best-selling book, The Power Game. PBS viewers saw Mr. Smith for 25 years as a principal panelist on Washington Week in Review and have seen him as a special correspondent on the Newsweek NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, and he's received 6 honorary doctorate degrees. His best-selling books include The Russians, Power Game, How Washington Works, and the New Russians, and Rethinking America. He was chosen for a prestigious Nieman Fellowship at Harvard in 1969 and 70. Mr. Smith, can I call you Rick?
I don't know. People are going to see the name on the book as Hedrick. Maybe
okay.
I'll stick with that.
All right. On the first page of your book, you quote Aristotle on politics. He stated, "Thus it is manifest the best political community is formed by citizens of the middle class, and that those states that are likely to be well administered, in which the middle class is large and stronger, if possible, than both of the other classes." Regarding that, on National Public Radio, not long ago, you stated that our greatest period of growth, especially for the middle class, came between 1943 and 1973. Mr. Smith, Hedrick Smith, what changed that positive economic dynamic that emerged from the New Deal, the winning of the war, and the GI Bill?
Well, there were two basic things that happened. One was there was a major power shift in Washington away from the middle class, because we've often forgotten that middle class prosperity in those 3 decades after World War II was accompanied by and rested on middle class political and economic power. There was a power shift in Washington, which put a lot more power in the hands of corporations and organized business interests. And we can go into that in some detail because it's a very interesting story. And that tilted policy in favor of business interests. There was a lowering of tax rates for corporations. There was a lowering of tax rates for people at the higher bracket. The minimum wage was not raised to keep up with the way the economy grew and average wages grew. The payroll tax, which hits middle-class people hard because everybody has to pay it, was doubled during that time. At the same time, taxes were coming down on the upper bracket. So that was one thing, and there were many other things that happened. The 401k plan got started. There was a change in corporate bankruptcy laws, all of which had a big impact on the middle class financially. The other thing that happened was what I call wedge economics, which is there was a cutting off of the middle class from the gains in the economy. They had been gaining in the 3 decades after World War II. Since 1973, the middle class has not gotten its share of the gains in the American economic growth.
Now, it's funny, then, it sort of reflects Eleanor Roosevelt's old statement of greed versus need. You described negatively the era that started late into the Carter administration and accelerated during the Reagan years as a period where business rebellion started to shift priorities towards business hegemony. You tell us that one of the chief progenitors of that shift was one Lewis Powell. Who was he?
Well, you know, this is one of the great surprises. Richard, this is a reporter's book. I started out with a bunch of questions. I knew the middle class was in trouble. I started working this in late 2009. You know, housing foreclosures, jobs being lost, unemployment rising 600,000 people a month, jobs being offshored. Everybody could see the middle class was in trouble, and I wanted to understand why. What had happened? How had we gone from this era of middle class prosperity and power, which made the American middle class the envy of the world, in these three decades after World War II up through the middle 70s, to an era where we had this gaping inequality in the economy? And as I went back in to the history, what I found was that the causes of our present problems are not in the last election or in this recession, but they go way back historically, and they go back eventually. I got led to this unlikely character. Lewis Powell was a famous corporate attorney from Richmond, Virginia, a Virginia aristocrat who was so prominent in legal circles that he was elected president of the American Bar Association at one point. And he was named to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon at the end of 1971. Served on the court for about 15, 16 years. Was a conservative, leaned on the conservative side, but not in a pronounced way, certainly not in
not
a
like today.
Way. But what I didn't know, and this was during a period where I was running the New York Times Washington Bureau in the late 70s, what I didn't know was that Powell had written a memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce saying that the American free enterprise system was under assault and was in mortal danger of being snuffed out by government regulation, by the power of labor unions, by the power of the consumer movement led by Ralph Nader, among others, and that business had to organize politically. It had to move into Washington in force. It had to form new organizations. It had to identify its political enemies, go after them aggressively. That was his term, aggressively, and take the high ground politically, take over, so that they could turn policy around. And that, in fact, is what happened. I mean, it's astonishing the impact of this Powell memo, which was unknown for a long time. And I can tell you, reporters at the time and even reporters today don't know much about the Powell memo. I talked to a group of about 40 or 50 reporters in Washington about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I was mentioning the Powell memo. I mean, people like Bob Schieffer of CBS, Jim Lehrer of PBS, Mark Shields of the Washington Post columnist, none of them knew about the Powell memo. There was only one other reporter in the room besides me who knew about the Powell memo. Mm. So it was hidden, but it had an enormous impact.
And he influenced the court to shift away from the New Deal and post-New Deal dominance that had existed through Earl Warren?
Well, my point is not about what he did on the court. I didn't analyze that. My point is what he did in the political arena before he went on to the court. He wrote this memo. It was circulated by the Chamber of Commerce. And astonishing things happened. Within 4 months, the 150 largest corporations in America formed the Business Roundtable. Now, today, the Business Roundtable is the most powerful voice of business, political voice of business in Washington. It has enormous influence. Before the Powell memo, it didn't exist. Those 150 corporations had not gotten together to use their political clout in Washington. And nowadays, whenever there's a tough bill coming up before Congress, the CEOs fly to Washington in very organized fashion to go around and see the committee chairman and the ranking members and the most powerful people in Congress and influence on legislation. That's just one example of what happened. Another example, quickly, at the time Powell wrote, there were 175 companies, only 175 companies, that had offices in Washington designed to lobby either the executive branch or the Congress on behalf of business. A decade later, there were 2,425. The membership in the National Federation of Independent Businesses, the arm of small business, had 4,000 members in 1971. By the end of the decade, they had 600,000 members. So business really got organized and started to use its political muscle.
You know, ironically, with this movement to the right and the election of a self-styled conservative who considered himself very pro-business, Richard Nixon, he sort of disappointed many of his business supporters. What happened with Nixon, and how did he appeal to the bipartisan consensus?
Well, I think you have to go back. This is a very different era. Bipartisanship was the prevailing political strategy in both parties. Republicans in those days worked across the aisle with Democrats in a way that they don't today. And the political extremes were not as strong at that time. Bipartisan policies were common to Lyndon Johnson, the Democrat, and Richard Nixon, a Republican who succeeded each other, you know, in the White House. Nixon was very pro-business. He loved cavorting with the business CEOs, the leaders. He admired the captains of industry. He would go down to Florida to B.B. Rebozo's place and vacation and hobnob with the business leaders or go out to San Clemente. But he was also a political realist. He was a pragmatist. And if you recall, the environmental movement, the consumer movement, the labor movement, the women's movement, the peace movement, they were all strong in that period. That was a period of citizen activism. 20 million people demonstrated on Earth Day in April 1970 against the fouling of America, the fouling of America's airs and waters. And within several months, Richard Nixon had established the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, Nixon was no tree-hugging environmentalist,
no,
but he was a pragmatist, and he understood that there was political pressure for this. There were seven or eight major pieces of environmental legislation that were passed: the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, Anti-Toxic Substances Act. Things like that were passed with huge bipartisan majorities. In some cases, there were only a handful of votes against them in the U.S. Senate. So this was extremely popular at that time. The politicians were responding to people, and the pressure was coming from the belly of the land, from the grassroots of America on Washington. Now, I mention that and take trouble to talk about it because that political climate is so different from today.
Right.
So in that climate, Richard Nixon realized that it was necessary to rein in the excesses of American capitalism, and he set up a number of regulatory agencies, and that was one of the things that really bugged Lewis Powell and caused Powell to write his memo. He said government regulation is strangling American business. And there was more regulation then than there is now. So you can see that the claims from the business side haven't changed. I mean, there's a big change in the political climate, but the charge and the pressure from business for less regulation has been consistent for the last 30 years.
Well, you can go back to the New Deal, and you can go back to the early days of the New Deal and NRA and read the same comments from the right. It's not unusual. It's sort of like an eternal struggle. Before we go to a break, I just... most people seem to think that this bipartisanship happened under Ronald Reagan. And you did mention this tremendous corporate lobby. Before we go to a break, who were some of the people they attacked, people like Nader, others? Who were some of the people they went after right away in this new era that evolved?
Which side are you talking about?
In terms of business lobby.
Who was going after whom?
Business lobbies going after...
business lobbies didn't go so much after people. They went after legislation. They did in the 1978 Congress, which was the pivotal Congress, pre-Reagan, by the way.
Right.
And this was a real discovery for me in writing this book, Who Stole the American Dream, that it was under Carter and the Democrats that we see a watershed, that we see a pivotal turn in American politics. The legislation that labor wanted to make it easier to organize, the legislation that Ralph Nader and the consumer movement wanted to establish the Consumer Protection Bureau, it was strangled in Congress. It never got out of Congress. What I call Powell's army, these organized business lobby groups, and there were 50,000 people working for business trade associations in Washington by the late 1970s. There were 9,000 registered corporate lobbyists. They outnumbered Congress 130-1. They were swarmed all over Capitol Hill, and they just killed this legislation. And then they got legislation of their own. They got the 401k program. We can talk more about that. They got a change in the corporate bankruptcy laws. They blew the lid off interest rates, which pleased Wall Street, but it set up the conditions for the subprime crisis that hit us in this past decade. They rolled back the tax laws. They cut the capital gains tax from 48% to 28%. I mean, it was a game changer. It was 78 Congress was kind of like one of those moments in a football game, pro football game, where there's an interception late in the fourth quarter and somebody runs it back 55 yards for a touchdown, and suddenly the way the game is going is turned and you know which team is going to win. That's what happened in American politics in 1978.
By the way, you're listening to my guest, journalist Hedrick Smith, author of Who Stole the American Dream. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX Radio, 1460 AM, live streaming at WVOX.com. Com. We've been talking about how the American economy shifted from a strong labor position in the post-war era where productivity soared along with wages to a business era where corporate compensation dwarfed their real wages. You know, from 1970 through 2000, Fortune 500 employees' compensation barely moved up in real dollars by possibly 10%. Conversely, CEOs of those same companies who've earned a ratio of 35 to 1 over their employees saw their brackets cut by 70% to a 75-year low of 28%, and their salary soared to 1,000 to 1 or a raise of 3,500%. Hedrick Smith, did the decline of organized labor, the exporting of jobs overseas, the shifting of the wealth to the 1% violate Aristotle's idea of the importance of the middle class to the strength of the best political community?
Well, you've been talking about economic things, and what Aristotle was talking about was political power, but they're connected. Yes, certainly if you have the middle class faring worse economically. I mean, I just want to underscore one critical thing that you said, because people don't know this, and if they hear it, it goes right by them. It needs to be underlined and emphasized. Productivity in the American economy from 1945 to about 1975, 1973, virtually doubled, and so did the wages and salaries of average Americans. Their standard of living rose as the American economy grew, as productivity grew, and as corporations grew. Starting in 1973, imagine the point of a wedge being driven right into the middle of the American economy. And on the upper side of the wedge, the people that you just described, the CEOs, the wealthy, and so forth, they continued to grow, as did productivity. Productivity went up 80% over the last 35 years or so. But the wages of people in the middle, the compensation of the people in the middle, imagine the bottom edge of that wedge now, they were pretty level. The Census Bureau told us that last year, that in 2011, the average male worker's hourly compensation, that is his wages and his benefits, and that's across the board, we're not just talking assembly line workers, we're talking average compensation for any walk of employment in the country, was flat. In fact, it was slightly lower, which meant there were three decades of going nowhere if you were in the middle class. And if you were a CEO, your pay for a big company, your pay rose 300 to 400% higher than it was back in the 1970s compared to your former colleagues, your predecessors. And if you were at the top 1%, your income rose 600%. So at the top, you've got a growth of 600%. And in the middle, average household income, average male pay and benefits is flat. That's the wedge. Certainly, when that happens, and particularly when you allow, when you have decisions like the Citizens United decision, which allows corporations to spend unlimited money for super PACs in political elections, certainly that kind of economic impact has political impact. And what you see is you see the gross inequality of incomes moving along with the stark inequality of power in the American political system. It's not just power in elections, but people forget is the most important power is the power that continues to be exercised after the vote is over. The lobbyists go to work when the voters are done. The voters think they've done their job. They clap their hands if they like the outcome. They walk away and say, okay, it's up to Obama or it's up to Clinton or it's up to Bush or it's up to whoever. They elect him. We don't have to worry about it anymore. But the people who really want to make government work for them, they start their work at that point, lobbying. And that's where the tilt is. And that's what's affected the middle class so gravely in terms of American policy.
You know, our long economic shift towards the hegemony of the economic elite saw some ugly bumps along the road, which included the disastrous savings and loan debacle of the 1980s, the second oil embargo, and a severe economic downturn in the first Reagan administration, the Volcker credit squeeze and huge peacetime deficits until Bill Clinton. Did supply-side economics pushed by Milton Friedman, Arthur Greenspan, Arthur Lather, and David Stockman fail the middle class?
Well, I think I've just laid out what I think failed the middle class, which is the wedge economics in the private sector. But certainly, government policies, which were designed to improve the profit margins of the corporations, and which made it in a tax system which made it attractive for corporations to move jobs overseas because they pay less income tax, corporate income tax, on profits made overseas than they do on profits made in America. Certainly those things hurt the middle class. There's no question about it. I mean, Greenspan was an architect of the housing boom, and the housing boom absolutely killed the middle class. People don't know it, but the middle class lost $6 trillion of home equity, which is the greatest source of middle class wealth, the money people have invested in their home mortgages. They lost $6 trillion of that accumulated wealth before the housing bubble burst, because Greenspan and others, the supply-side economists among them, were encouraging people to take money out of their homes and say, you know, home prices are going to go up forever. It doesn't matter. You've got a lot of money accumulated in your home. Start using your mortgage as an ATM machine. Cash out. Go take vacations. Go buy a second car. Some people were doing that. A lot more people were simply buying necessities, medical care, education for their kids, an improvement in their homes, the car they needed to get to work, and they needed two cars because two people were working. It wasn't luxury, it was necessity, and they had to do that because their pay wasn't going up. Remember, I just said,
right,
pay stayed level for three decades. And Greenspan and the Federal Reserve loved this policy. Why? Because people were sucking out $750 billion a year from their home equity and turning that into consumer demand. And Richard, it's really important for people to get this. Consumer demand, the demand of average, ordinary, middle-class Americans, that is the job creator. Those are the job creators. It's not the wealthy at the top. American business is not short of capital. There was a story in the New York Times about 2 weeks ago in which they reported that there were venture capitalist funds that had collected $1 trillion of investment money from pension funds and other big investors around the country, and they couldn't find any businesses to invest in that they thought were good investments. So they were thinking about returning the investment money to the investors, the rich people who had the money. So the capital shortage is not our problem. Our problem today is the low wages that the middle class is being paid. Low wages means low demand means low economic growth. That's the structural problem that we have today. So yes, these economic policies have not only hurt the middle class, they've hurt the country. We can't grow our economy, and we keep looking to Washington to fix it, and as long as people are voting against stimulus in Washington, Washington can't fix it. It's got to be fixed in the private sector, and the private sector is sitting on its money. And why is it sitting on this money? There's no consumer demand, and there's no consumer demand because companies like Caterpillar are insisting on a wage freeze even while they have record profits.
Yeah. You know, the real economic meltdown that still affects America finally came with the Bush 43 administration's non-regulation policy, large tax cuts, a superheated housing market which spun off worthless derivatives, causing not only the great market meltdown 2008, but the worldwide recession. Who were the victims of those policies, and why did companies like Countrywide Financial and its clones, who sold 84% of the mortgages, and banks like Goldman Sachs, Citibank, Merrill Lynch, and their executives, escape punishment from this type of almost a Ponzi scheme of selling to their clients these potential riches that had no substance or no backing? Why did these executives escape punishment? Was it something that the Obama administration felt it had to do to preserve the system?
Well, I think we ought to get straight a couple of things that are important here. One is the main victims of subprime mortgages were not poor people or people who had bad credit records. They were people who had prime credit records. They were people who were entitled to prime loans. There are people who are paying their mortgages and they're still stuck in them. 10, 15 million of them are stuck in houses that are worth less than what they bought. To me, it was a great shock to discover that. They were, to get to your point, they were cajoled, hoodwinked, bamboozled, cheated into mortgage loans at high interest rates with high fees and all kinds of high bonuses called yield spread premiums for the mortgage brokers and the bankers. And they deserved much better. So there's no question that lots of people were cheated. And if you read my book, Who Stole the American Dream, you will actually see that some of the best loan performers for Washington Mutual, which is the biggest bank failure in American history,
WaMu.
Like WaMu, just like Countrywide, that there was enormous fraud going on, which WaMu even discovered. WaMu's own investigators discovered the fraud. Now, my question is similar to yours. How come those people didn't get prosecuted? The answer is that some of them did, but they were mid-level people. They weren't top-level people. Angelo Mozzillo, who was the CEO of Countrywide, paid a fine. I can't forget the exact amount, but it's around $60 million. About $20 million of it was paid by him. About $40 million of it was paid by Bank of America, which bought out Countrywide. And there are a lot of people who think that he was willing to pay the fine because otherwise he faced criminal prosecution for marketing what many people consider fraudulent loans. And certainly people further down the line in Washington Mutual and so forth actually did go to jail for perpetrating fraudulent loans. But, yeah, there's a question that you've raised, which is important, and it's unanswered. Why didn't the Obama administration go in and prosecute some of these people? Because business can often afford to pay big fines. I mean, Goldman Sachs paid a $500 million fine, $500 million fine, which sounds like a lot of money, but it rolls off the back of Goldman Sachs, which is such a huge company that they don't notice it after a year or two. Why weren't some people prosecuted? Well, one of the reasons is simple. Our security laws are full of loopholes, and they're very hard to enforce. For example, there were more than 800 companies in which the CEOs and the boards of directors falsified the dates on which stock options were given and cheated the system in order to give the CEOs big bonuses even when their companies were doing badly and the stock price was going down, which is the exact opposite of what the system is designed to do. It's supposed to reward them when the stock price and the company performance goes up, but in at least 850 cases, and among them Apple and Steve Jobs are very prominent. I got all the details in this book. They weren't prosecuted because, believe it or not, cheating on stock options, which is actually cheating stockholders. Stockholders of the company are getting cheated by the management of the company that they have supposedly hired on their behalf. It's not illegal. There are a whole lot of things. For Goldman Sachs, they paid a fine. It's not illegal to do what they did. It wasn't fraudulent. It was what most people would consider fraudulent, but it's not legally fraudulent. They sold some investments, derivatives, to banks, and then they turned around and they bet against them because they thought it was a lousy investment. And so the question comes, how can you sell your customers something and then turn around and bet against it? Isn't that illegal? Shouldn't it be illegal? It's like selling somebody a car that you know is going to break down when they drive out the driveway of the used car lot. That's illegal. But in the securities laws, it's not illegal. So part of the problem here, Richard, is the laws are very poorly written. And they're very poorly written on purpose. It's the impact of the business lobbyists that I was talking about. This is what Powell's army has done over the years, is to make sure that the laws are not written so tightly that it's prosecuted. And then the other reason, I think, is what you suggested. I think the Obama administration did not want to get into a huge number of criminal fights. They did try a couple of cases, and they got ruled against by the courts, and the cases may not have been as well argued and as well presented as they could have been. But they took that as a signal. They went after a couple of brokers who worked for Bear Stearns. They lost those cases, and they just sort of backed down on criminal prosecution.
I think you described it very interestingly. It's, you know, here in our neck of the woods, so when we see a very small fine for dumping, it's called a license to pollute. And you do mention a very interesting story in your book, and I recommend it. I have it right in front of me, about Al Dunlap of Sunbeam, and very much parallels other issues where the stockholders get raped, ripped off, seduced and abandoned, and the fines are paid, and the Angelo Mozzillos and the Al Dunlaps walk away with fortunes, as you recall in your book, very interesting, Homie Has, and how the Sunbeam stockholders paid for. Before we go to the next break, a short statement, getting back to the new economy in the 1990s, Warren Buffett, one of the richest men in the world, said, there's a class warfare, all right, but it's my class, the rich class, that's making war, and we're winning. in a sense, Hedrick Smith, is this the real redistribution of income that we've seen?
Absolutely. Income has flowed upward. We have this ridiculous political debate about whether or not trickle-down economics works or doesn't work. Trickle-down economics doesn't exist. It used to exist, but it doesn't exist. Money has moved upward. Remember, I just said to you a couple minutes ago that $6 trillion of accumulated wealth in home mortgages that people had built up carefully, painfully over the years in their home equity was transferred from the middle class to the Wall Street banks. In the late 1980s, Americans owned 70% of the value of their homes, 70%. By 2008, 2009, they only owned 40%. What that means is 30% of the ownership share in American home equity moved from the homeowners, the borrowers, the middle class, to Wall Street, to the banks, and to the big investors. That's an enormous, that's probably the largest transfer of wealth that's ever occurred in American history. And not only did that happen, but the 401k system also moved financial risk and responsibility and cost from companies to individuals. The middle class lost that way, too. There are a whole number of ways in which the middle class lost through these policies of the new economy. It was hailed as a new economy. It's supposed to be bright and wonderful, and the old economy is supposed to be stodgy and
antiquated.
Inefficient and antiquated. It was a heck of a lot better break in the old economy for the middle class than it is in the new economy, and we're not going to get to a good growing economy until we get a better sharing of the wealth, which smacks of the old economy, smacks of the old-time CEOs who believed in what they called stakeholder corporate policy for the stakeholders. They said, people who ran GM, GE, Standard Oil, New Jersey, people who ran the biggest corporations in America in the 50s, 60s, and 70s believed it was their job to help all the stakeholders, and that included workers and included customers and included suppliers and creditors, not just the shareholders. That's been turned on its head. And now profit and pushing up the stock price is the thing that drives guys like Al Dunlop. Al Dunlop had a stock ticker literally outside his office, and he looked at it. Every time I walked in and out of his office with him, he always checked the price. That's what motivated him. He cut plants, he cut workers, he shifted jobs overseas, all because he knew that was going to boost the stock price in Wall Street. And then, as Barron's reported, and I've got it in the book, he got into what they call stuffing the inventory chain. He pretended things had been sold that hadn't been sold,
right.
And he left the company and had to pay a fine under a stockholder's suit.
And he's doing very well.
That's right. He's got a very comfortable.
And you know, it's sort of like what Henry Ford, who wasn't the greatest Democrat that ever lived, said when he paid $5 a day, which was unheard of wage. His rationale was he wanted his employees to be able to afford his car, which is the bottom line to regarding, again, the understanding of the importance of middle class. My guest is journalist Hedrick Smith, author of Who Stole the American Dream. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX Radio, 1460 AM, live streaming at WVOX. Hedrick Smith wrote this wonderful book. I've been focusing the last few weeks on trying to talk about our economy and where it's been going. In this conversation today, we've been talking about how the concentration of wealth and the rise of the corporate too-big-to-fail entities seem to author the crash of 2008 and survive the aftermath. You write that many Americans complain about the exporting of jobs, their own economic insecurity, and obviously we are also a society addicted to fast food, guns, drug use, energy consumption. Much of our high crime statistics are a product of many of our innate societal habits. Hedrick Smith, aren't the American people being a bit unrealistic about themselves? And do they read their own press clippings?
Well, you're into a whole lot of subjects there, Richard, that I have not focused on. I'm really interested in economic performance, economic results, and what's happened to our political system. I think that it is fair to say that people are not being told a straight story, and therefore they're not always operating in their own self-interest. I mean, we're being told by folks that we can import anything we want from China, We should be able to buy anything we want. We should have a limitless credit. I mean, if you want to follow bankruptcies are now more common than cancer and divorce in America, personal bankruptcies. And part of that is the credit system that is encouraging people to go into debt. People are being given credit that never would be given credit in the old days because their record for repayment is bad. And the people who are running the credit system, the credit cards, the banks are making money off those people much more than they are off the people who can manage credit and pay off their credit. So there's a symbiosis here between the urge to consume on the part of the consumers and the encouragement to wild consumption, wild debt by the banks. And by the way, we ought to recognize here, in terms of debt, Wall Street banks and the big banks in America have a debt themselves that is twice as large as the federal debt, okay? So indebtedness begins with the Wall Street banks, indebtedness in America. So when you start to hear the bankers and other people talk about how American middle-class folks are being profligate and so forth, it is true. But the bankers are leading the way. They're doing it themselves. I mean, and to a certain extent, some debt is necessary. I mean, companies need to invest in new plants and equipment. They raise money by selling stock, or they take a loan. People take a loan to finance their kids' education. The kids take out loans. People take a loan to buy a house because it takes a long time to pay off those things. Not all debt is bad, but we've got runaway debt in this country, and it's runaway debt all across the board. It's at the personal level. It's at the bank level, and it's at the government level. And we do need to restrain it, and actually we have been restraining it a bit. Since the recession hit in 2008-2009, people have been pulling back, and that's understandable. That's also one of the problems we have now.
That's right.
That's
why slower growth.
It's slower growth.
So. You know, along with our changing technology, right in line with what we've been talking about, featuring robotics, the computer, the internet. People are shopping now more and more of the internet. They're not driving around at $4.25 gasoline. High domestic labor, of course. This feeds something that you've talked about a lot in your book, globalization. Isn't the public who wants cheap Chinese goods, and we did mention this credit card, open credit card, marketed by Walmart, which used to be Sam Walton, lived by the mantra, buy American.
Yeah, but that was phony even when he was doing it. That was phony even when he was doing it. While he was using that mantra, he was beginning to buy big in China.
Right.
It was a boat. I mean, I've got managers inside Walmart who have left. Otherwise, they wouldn't be talking to me about this stuff. But they said they were making enormous profits off goods from China. And Sam Walton was talking out of both sides of his mouth.
He had that paper bag lunch and his pickup truck, as I recall. You know, we've been engaged in two long and costly wars. You've spent a lot of time in your life on foreign policy, writing about Russia, globalization, etc. And the struggle against worldwide terror is on top of these wars. Some now are even saber-rattling over Syria and Iraq, intervene in Syria. I don't know which side to intervene on. Every day there's another side. What has been the cost and economic impact of these wars on our nation state?
I'm going to do that, but I hope you come back to globalization because I want to talk about the American example compared to Germany. The cost of defense has soared. We are now spending $200 billion a year on defense, not counting the war costs. In the basic Pentagon budget, $200 billion more than we were spending at the peak of the Cold War when we faced a nuclear-armed global competitor in the Soviet Union. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And if you listen to Capitol Hill, they will say, oh, we can't afford to cut. We can't cut anything. We need all the weapons. One of the reasons why that's going on in Capitol Hill is the people who make the big weapon systems in America, the bombers, the destroyers, the tanks, the large weapon systems, have been very smart. What they've done is they've found companies in practically every congressional district that contribute something: electronics, tracks, bullets, shells, engines, propellers, whatever, and they spread it out. So whenever somebody says, hey, we got to cut a weapon system or we got to cut something in Congress, the lobbyists run to the congressman and say, hey, that's going to cause 250 or 1,000 or 10,000 jobs in your district, because in your district There's this company that makes the fan belts that drives the engines, that works in the destroyer or the aircraft carrier.
Military industrial complex.
This is exactly what Dwight Eisenhower warned about. Right. And one of the things that's typical of countries in the late stages of their power is what the historian call imperial overstretch. What happens is, and this has happened to Britain historically, this happened to Spain, it happened to Holland, it happened to, if you go back in history, it's happened to a whole bunch of people. David Kennedy writes about it in his great book, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers. And what it is countries start out with strong economies, and then they go out and they get involved in world trade, and they push their military power out to the edges of where they go in world trade. And then their economies start to grow more slowly, and then they level off, and they may even start to decline, but they keep all these overseas bases. That's what we've done. We got 1,000 bases overseas, huge defense establishment. We're continuing to buy very modern arms that even people like Senator John McCain, the hero of the Vietnam War, has said, do not add to the combat capability of American forces. We're spending defense money as if it were water. You finally got mayors around the country saying, wait a minute, why are we building bridges in Kandahar and Afghanistan instead of in Kansas City? Yeah. Our own infrastructure, our own transportation system is in terrible shape, and defense spending is gobbling up everything. And you have at least a whole lot of people, particularly in one party, that are saying, you can't cut a penny from defense, you're going to sacrifice America's security. Not true. Right. You've got plenty of defense experts saying, we don't need to spend all this money. If we could get by with $200 billion less facing the Soviet Union, which had nuclear-armed aircraft and missiles and all that kind of stuff, we don't need to be spending that much now.
Hedrick Smith, we have a larger Navy than the whole world put together. I certainly believe in strong defense, but our defense budget is larger than the whole world together. We only have a minute or so left.
Got to talk about Germany, because Germany...
Go quick on this. I got only a minute or so, and give me a minute on Germany.
All right. People say manufacturing is dead in America. People say they can't pay higher wages. We can't compete. Germany, in the last 25 years, their big corporations have raised pay of average workers 5 times faster than in America. They ran a trade surplus in the last decade, $2 trillion. They sold more to the world than they bought. We had a $6 trillion deficit. We bought $6 trillion more than we sold. And they've got 21% of their workforce in manufacturing, which is the best kind of jobs you can have, not only for the workers, but the engineers, the designers, the advertising agencies, the grocery stores, the automobile dealerships, everybody who deals with those folks, and we have only 9%. There's a different strategy.
And their salaries are high. Try to just buy German goods.
Better than we do.
Right. It's a very interesting point. I think that's the exceptional point. Quickly, in 10, 15 seconds, can we get out of our political mess, and is the election going to make a difference? Can Obama work if the Congress still stays the way it is?
Well, fundamentally, yes, the election makes a difference, but we took 30 years to get in trouble. We're not going to get out of trouble in 6 months or 4 years.
I think you're 100% right. It's going to be very interesting where we go regarding this. Unfortunately, we're out of time. It's a fascinating, it'll be an hour when we fill in the commercials. I want to thank you, Hedrick Smith, for joining me on The Advocates and speaking to these critical issues.
Get people to get out and get that book, Who Stole the American Dream?
They'll read it, and if they have a half a brain, they'll understand it. Speaking on these critical issues and how we should address the ongoing debate regarding government and social and economic policies. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access on my website. Also, all the authors and books are listed at advocates-wvox.com. Information on all my guests will be posted. Next week, I'll be talking about the American worker and where he stands today regarding things we've discussed already on this program. Thank you, Mr. Smith, for joining me. We have a short period left. Any new projects on the way?
No, I believe so passionately that it's important to get the word out on the actual facts of American politics and economics that I'm concentrating right now, and just simply talking with people like yourself to get the issues out there. I think people don't have a good understanding. I think the press has not done as good a job as we should have done. Our job is to dig into the past, see what the track record shows, call balls and strikes, call foul and fair. Let people know, for example, that some of our best growth occurred when tax rates were high.
Right.
92%, 77% under Kennedy and Eisenhower. Some of our worst growth risk occurred when tax rates are low under George W. Bush and Barack Obama. So don't let somebody fool you that lowering taxes is going to bring growth. What's going to bring growth is paying workers more and increasing the share of America's wealth enjoyed by the American middle class.
And having
middle
them able to be consumers. Thank you very much again. Have a great day. And thanks for joining the Advocates. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
On your position, and that's fine. Every, you know, you have a right to your view like anyone else does, but we haven't even looked at